come out at once. Do you know if this particular painting was sold before or after he came to the U.S., and who he might have sold it to? Ms. Fournier pulled off her glasses and folded them carefully. Might I ask, Ms. Nichols, why you're interested in the business dealings of a man dead almost 30 years? Jay spoke up. Leslie's grandmother passed away recently, and she's handling the estate. She was curious how this painting might have come into her family's possession. Emily shifted her gaze to Leslie. I'm not interested in buying it. Good, Leslie answered, bristling, because it's not for sale. Jay seemed to sense that things were about to get out of hand. Miss Fournier, our intent isn't to sell the painting. We were only hoping you could provide a little history, since it passed through your grandfather's personal collection. Your last name is Davenport, she said, as if she hadn't heard a word he'd said. Your face is familiar. What is your first name? It's Jay, short for James, but you may know me as J.D. Hartwell. The writer, I thought so. Your last book, the one about the World War II pilot, was set here in Charleston. It was very popular with the locals. Even I read it. A little mushy for my taste, but you did the town justice. Every writer wants to set a story in Charleston these days, but can't be bothered doing their homework. You and Conroy are the only ones who got it right. Jay beamed at her. I can't tell you how pleased I am to have the endorsement of a Charleston native, Miss Fournier. Please, call me Emily. Will you have more tea or something stronger? Then, as an afterthought, Miss Nichols? When they declined, Emily settled back against the edge of her desk, slender legs crossed at the ankles. Fine, then. North Carolina's a long way to come. What is it you want to know? Jay was the first to speak. It would be helpful if you could tell us when your grandfather sold his collection, and, if at all possible, who the buyers were. We know it's a long shot, but we were hoping maybe there were some old records. As a matter of fact, my grandfather was rather particular when it came to his records. Every piece he ever bought or sold was catalogued in a series of ledgers. Leslie set her tea aside and scooted to the edge of her chair. And you have these books? I do. I don't suppose you'd let us see them? No. But I may be able to tell you what you want to know. After you called, I did a little digging. Opening the desk drawer, she took out a sheet of paper and held it at arm's length as she read aloud. 5 Oils by Jeremiah Tanner, sold in March of 1941 to Henry Gavin of Peak Plantation, North Carolina. It seems at one time your great-grandfather owned more than just the Rebecca, Miss Nichols. And did the ledger say how much he might have paid? Emily nodded coolly. You're not going to tell me, are you? Suffice it to say that, for the time, it was a considerable amount of money. Leslie counted to 10. She was quickly losing her patience. Was there any information about how your grandfather happened to connect with the buyer? I ask because my great-grandfather was a tobacco farmer who didn't know the first thing about art. Emily's lips pursed. That would explain his taste. Jay threw Leslie a sharp look of warning. You're not a fan of Tanner's work, Emily? Let's just say he's not my cup of tea. Leslie's eyes shifted briefly to the painting on the easel. I don't understand. The way he captured her expression, it's so alive, so sensual. That takes talent. Emily Fournier gave a delicate sniff. Hardly fitting praise for what was supposed to be a religious study. But then, that was always Tanner's fatal flaw. He never approached his work with anything like reverence, choosing to exploit the corporeal instead. Leslie spied the glint of metal at Emily's throat and realized she was toying with a small crucifix. She blinked at it. Was it really as simple as that? Could this credentialed woman with her tidy hair and no-nonsense manner be so offended by the sensuality of Tanner's work that she refused to see his talent? Suddenly, she couldn't help pointing out the obvious. Your grandfather must have appreciated Tanner's work to go to the trouble of collecting every piece. Emily smiled, a mix of irritation and indulgence. My grandfather may have been a connoisseur of fine art, Miss Nichols, but he was also a man. You're saying his interest had more to do with the appreciation of women than with the merits of the artist? Not women, Miss Nichols. Woman. The same woman. The same face over and over again in every one of Tanner's paintings. I'm afraid she was something of an obsession for my grandfather. Leslie found the idea vaguely unsettling. That's odd, isn't it? To be obsessed with an image Tanner might have conjured out of thin air? Ah, but he didn't. She was real, or was. She was Tanner's common-law wife. They met in the U.S., and she followed him to Paris. She returned alone several years later. He died in Montmartre, like so many French artists, an opium addict, I believe, heavily in debt and rumored to have contracted syphilis. Leslie said nothing, recalling similar words in the magazine articles. Jay's eyes were still on the Rebecca. How is that even possible when a man has this kind of talent? You assume success in the art world is always about talent, Mr. Davenport. It isn't. Tanner had two strikes against him. He was black, for one, which made finding a wealthy patron all but impossible. More damning, though, was his subject matter. A country famed for the cathedral at Notre Dame wasn't quite comfortable seeing history's most sacred women portrayed as sex objects. It's a conflict for a lot of people, myself included. It can be difficult to remain objective about art that offends your personal beliefs. My family never understood. Her eyes were bent on the carpet now, fingers working the crucifix. She glanced up with a wavering smile. I don't know why I told you that. Forgive me. Miss Fournier, Leslie said with newfound patience. Emily, I didn't come to dredge up old wounds. I just want to know more about my family. I've got all these questions, but there's no one left to ask. There are gaps, things I may never know, about my mother and other people. That's why I hoped you could help. But if this is uncomfortable, we'll leave right now. Emily's expression softened. That isn't necessary. I'll help however I can, though I can't imagine why anything I could tell you would be of any use. I believe you asked if I knew how the sale came about. Yes, I did. Aside from Tanner's work, there isn't another piece of art in the house of any consequence, and I can't imagine a tobacco farmer traveling in the same circles as an art dealer. It's my understanding that Mr. Gavin made the initial contact. It wasn't until things started coming apart that my grandfather finally agreed to the sale. When he lost most of his money, he had little choice. He liquidated nearly all of his personal collection, keeping only the things he couldn't bear to part with. Everything else went to keeping the gallery afloat. It had to be terrible, parting with so many beautiful things, losing everything he'd worked for and loved. Come with me, Miss Nichols. There's something I want to show you. Leslie followed, jerking her head for Jay to come along. They stepped across the hall to the closed door opposite Emily's office. The room was dark and masculine, not so very different from Henry's study with its requisite desk, leather chairs, and massive fireplace. An enormous portrait filled the space above the mantel. Leslie's mouth sagged open. It's called Eve and the Serpent. Emily said without fanfare. Tana's sixth and last known work.
It was magnificent, a life-size depiction of Claude Fournier's obsession, nude but for the snake writhing sinuously about the model's torso, poised to strike one ripe breast.
Her dark head was thrown back, lips parted, as ripe as the fruit she had just plucked from the tree of knowledge.
"He kept one," Leslie breathed.
"Yes," Emily said, "to my grandmother's everlasting shame."
"I take it she didn't approve," Jay asked, craning his neck. "According to family legend, the day my grandfather bought it, my grandmother threatened to move out of their bedroom. When he refused to sell it with the others, she finally did. Till the day she died, she refused to enter this room."
Jay had yet to look away from the painting. "Do we know the model's name?"
"It was Vivian. I can't give you a last name. She usually went by Tana, though they were never married. At one time, my grandmother was convinced my grandfather had hired someone to find her when he learned she was back in the States."
Leslie dragged her eyes from the portrait.
"Did he?"
Emily shrugged. "I have no idea. For all the damage she did, he may as well have kept her in an apartment across town."
Jay finally dropped his eyes to Emily. "I can't help wondering why, with such negative associations, you keep it. Why not sell it, or at least take it down?"
Emily actually grinned. "Was that an offer?"
"No, I only meant..."
"I know what you meant. I was teasing. The truth is, I can't. Nothing in this house actually belongs to me. It's mine to enjoy as long as I live, but I can't sell it or move a single stick of furniture. When I die, everything goes to the Charleston Historical Society. I'm an only child and never married, so there's no one left. And now, before I air any more family laundry, let's go fetch your painting from my office and get you two back on the road. It's a long drive back to North Carolina."
Chapter 34. Jay. Jay said nothing on the short drive to the restaurant. Leslie seemed not to notice, too busy, he suspected, trying to forge some kind of link between Tanner's paintings and Adele Laveau to bother with small talk. Not that they'd heard anything that tied back to Adele. Maybe, when she realized she couldn't make it fit, she'd finally leave the whole subject alone. Maybe. Not that he was off the hook. Back at the Battery, before his cell phone had saved him, he'd been about to spill the whole thing, everything he knew or thought he knew, the journal full of notes, the fledgling manuscript in his desk, his meddling in her father's health issues. But by the time he hung up, there hadn't been time. Now, he wasn't sure he had the nerve. High Cotton sat at the corner of East Bay and Faber, its green canvas awning fluttering gently in the balmy breeze. Jay held the door, then followed Leslie into the dimly lit foyer. It was early, quiet, except for a jazz trio tuning up in the lounge. Maybe they should start there, have a drink to take the edge off. But that would just prolong the inevitable. The hostess arrived, showing them to a cozy corner table, which she proudly informed them had been dubbed the most romantic table in Charleston by Southern Living magazine. Jay eyed the framed article mounted to the windowsill as he took his seat. Under other circumstances, perhaps, but he had the distinct feeling that tonight was going to end up being about as romantic as the siege on Fort Sumter. Their waiter arrived, delivering an impeccable recitation of the evening specials, then suggested they might like to start with a bottle of wine. Jay waved away the wine list. "The lady's the expert. I'll leave the choice to her." Leslie shot him daggers as she accepted the heavy leather folder. After a moment, she closed it and handed it back. "I don't see peak sellers listed. I don't suppose you have a bottle of their Chardonnay by any chance?" Jay stifled a laugh in his water glass.
"I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that label, ma'am."
Leslie feigned surprise, then cool disappointment.
That's too bad. I thought it might pair nicely with the scallops. Well, if you don't have the peak, the Sonoma Couture will do.
The Sonoma, then, he said, nodding crisply. A very nice choice.
Jay waited until he was sure the waiter was out of earshot, then leaned close. That was laying it on a bit, don't you think?
$20 says he's in the back right now, asking the wine steward if he's ever heard of us.
Jay shook his head, chuckling. I've created a monster.
The Chardonnay wasn't long in coming. After placing their orders, they sipped their wine and nibbled warm bread, chatting easily about the weeks he'd spent in Charleston doing research. His thoughts never stopped turning, though. He never should have waited so long to come clean. He didn't know where to begin or how to explain why keeping the truth from her had seemed like the right thing to do.
I can see why you like this place, Leslie said, interrupting his thoughts. It's charming, very Charleston, but then you know Charleston, you and Conroy, that is.
She was taunting him with Emily Fournier's remarks and clearly enjoying herself in the process.
You can wipe that smirk off your face. Our hostess was merely expressing pride in her birthplace. They take it very seriously.
She liked you.
She liked my book.
No, she called the book mushy. It was you she liked.
She tore off another hunk of bread and began to butter it.
So, does that smile come natural?
What smile?
The one you turned on Emily at precisely the right moment. I was just wondering if you had to work to perfect it.
Jay did his best to look wounded. I don't think I like what I've just been accused of. Besides, what was I supposed to do? We were 5 minutes from getting tossed out on our ear. She really got under your skin.
In the beginning, Leslie admitted, then I saw what an act it all was, to keep people from seeing how unhappy she is. I get that. You think being prickly will keep you safe, but all it ends up doing is keeping you alone.
She set down her glass then and laid a hand on his sleeve.
I wasn't very nice when I came back to Peak. I'm sorry for that. Sorry for not seeing what Maggie meant to you, for suspecting you of, well, a lot of awful things. Growing up the way I did made me believe everyone had an angle, so you couldn't just be this nice guy who cared about my grandmother. She shrugged. Life with Jimmy, I guess, but you didn't deserve it.
Jay squirmed uncomfortably in his chair, wishing he could bolt from the table or at least ask Leslie to stop talking. Maybe he hadn't come to Peak with an angle, but he sure as hell couldn't claim anything like innocence. Not when he was sitting on 200 pages of unfinished Gavin family history and purposely keeping it from her. And now he'd added Jimmy to his list of transgressions. He'd rather not contemplate the fallout when she learned he'd been meddling in the man's medical affairs, or that after 6 long years, he'd picked up the phone and instructed his agent to pitch the manuscript so he could foot Jimmy's medical bills, and all to help a man Leslie despised. In retrospect, it seemed like a pretty bad idea, and one Leslie wasn't likely to forgive anytime soon. But it was too late for regrets and much, much too late to examine his motives. The wheels were in motion. Maybe there was nothing to be done for the old bastard, but if there was, well then, he'd just have to let the pieces fall. It was time to face the music.
Leslie, there are a few things.
Before he could get the rest of the words out, their waiter appeared with an armful of appetizers, and he was forced to bide his time until the food was served and the glasses topped off. By the time they were finally alone again, Leslie had begun nibbling at one of the crab cakes and was portioning out paper-thin slices of tuna. She paused, her fork halfway to his mouth.
"What's wrong? Aren't you hungry?"
Jay accepted the bite, chewing mechanically. The dining room was beginning to fill. Strains of jazz filtered in from the lounge, piano and bass mingling with the low hum of conversation. Outside, the day was slipping away, the streetlights winking on. He was in his favorite city.
his favorite restaurant, and he was with Leslie. Surely what he had to say could wait until after dinner. "It's a shame we have to hurry right back," Leslie said, interrupting his thoughts. "It would be fun to do a little exploring, and after that meeting, I could use a little fun." Jay mustered a grin. "You don't classify sparring with Emily Fournier as a good time?" "No, I do not. And I'd be lying if I didn't say I'm disappointed. The only thing we know now that we didn't know when we left home is that Emily's grandfather had a fetish for Tanner's so-called wife. We knew there was a good chance Henry bought the paintings from him. We just didn't know why. And we still don't. I mean, why go all the way to Charleston for them? And then there's the question of the money. It was 1941. The Depression was just ending. How would he have money to blow on art?" "That's an easy one. Henry never trusted banks. Maggie said he would come home from the Smithfield market with his pockets full of cash. To her knowledge, he never put a dime of it in the bank. It wasn't unusual back then, especially in the South, and it would explain his remaining afloat when so many had lost everything." "That might explain how he bought them, but not why." "Does the why really matter?" Leslie pushed her plate back and folded her arms on the edge of the starched white tablecloth. "It's one more thing that doesn't fit, so yes, why does matter. I was really hoping Emily would tell us something that tied those paintings to Adele." "Such as?" Leslie shrugged. "I have no idea. Something about her life, maybe. How she died, and why. Instead, I'm back to square one." Jay was more than relieved to see the waiter arriving with their meals. She'd have her answers soon enough. For now, though, he wanted to savor the evening a little before whatever had started between them came crashing down around his ears. "Do you realize," he said, raising his wine glass, "that we've been talking about dead people all day? Here's to changing the subject and to enjoying an outstanding meal together. By the way, they're very strict about dessert here. That praline souffle you ordered won't leave the kitchen until you've cleaned your plate." When dinner was over, the last vestiges of their shared souffle scraped from its ramekin, they stepped out into the nighttime bustle of East Bay Street. Instead of heading back to the car, Jay took Leslie's arm and steered her across the street toward the pier at Waterfront Park, silently rehearsing the opening lines of his confession. He had decided at some point during dessert not to wait for the drive back. He wanted to be able to say he had looked her in the eye when he finally told her the truth. She deserved at least that much. He was conscious of the occasional brush of her body against his as they strolled to the end of the pier, their footsteps hollow on the weathered boards. As it was on most nights, the pavilion was filled with young lovers, huddled against the breeze around tables or in long, slatted swings. The gullah peddlers were about, too, many of them children, selling woven sweetgrass roses to amorous tourists. He was glad to find the end of the pier empty, the long, low benches deserted. He loved it here, especially at night when the air was sharp and fresh, thick with the brackish perfume of the marsh. Closing his eyes, he breathed it in, listening to the languid wash of the tide moving through reeds and shells, a queer and beautiful music. When he opened his eyes again, Leslie was at the railing beside him, face tipped toward the breeze, shivering visibly. "You're cold. We should head back to the car."
"Oh, no. It's beautiful here. Just get behind me and block the wind."
Jay stepped as close as he could without touching. He needed to keep a clear head.
"Hmm," she murmured, nuzzling her head back against him. "That's better."
Instinctively, his arms crept around her waist, cinching her close until her hips were warm and firm against him.
Her hair smelled like lilies and rain.
"Thank you for today, Jay," she said quietly. "You were the one who finally broke the ice with Emily. Then that delicious dinner, and now this?"
"Leslie?"
"I know," she said softly. "We should be getting back."
But neither of them moved, and Jay couldn't seem to make his tongue work. Everything was perfect, too perfect to ruin with talk of her father or of surreptitiously written manuscripts. He couldn't say how much time passed before he realized they were swaying almost imperceptibly, moving to the ebb and swell of the water below. Leslie must have realized it too. Turning in his arms, she found his mouth, tentative at first, then surer, hungrier. Before he could check himself, he was leaning into her, savoring the slight, sweet strokes of her tongue, breaths mingled, swaying still with the quiet insistence of the sea. Finally, through the rhythmic white noise, his senses returned. If he went through with this now, he'd be risking something he suddenly knew he wanted very badly, perhaps irrevocably. Sliding his hands to her shoulders, he pushed her away, holding her at arm's length. "Leslie, we have to talk. There are things I need to tell you." Her eyes were bright in the moonlight, heavy-lidded and confused. She reached up to touch his face, her fingertips chilly against his cheek. "We've been talking all day. I don't want to talk anymore. I know what I want. I think it's what you want, too. Let's not go back tonight. Let's stay." When she tried to close the new distance between them, he kept his arm firm. "I don't mean small talk, Leslie. There are things you need to know before we take this any further." Taking his hand, she folded it in on itself, kissing each knuckle with deliberate slowness. "I know how I feel, and that's enough. We're here now, and it's like a little piece of magic. Peak will still be there tomorrow. We can talk then. We'll compare scars, if that's what you want. You can tell me your secrets, and I'll tell you mine, but none of it will change what I feel now, what I want now." "Leslie..." But the rest of what he meant to say died on his tongue as he gazed down at her, his blood thundering in two places at once. "Please," she whispered against his neck, "before the magic disappears and it's just real life again." Jay didn't know how to say no. She was so beautiful, her eyes luminous in the moonlight, an irresistible force. When she spoke again, the words came so softly they were lost on the breeze, but in the moonlight he could read her lips. "Let's stay," they said again. Chapter 35. Leslie woke to sunlight knifing through unfamiliar blinds. There was a moment of disorientation, of trying to reconcile the deeply carved posts of an old plantation bed with the masculine leg pressed against her hip, and then last night began to flood back, the exquisite abandon of wills and limbs, breath to breath and skin to skin. Beside her, Jay was still asleep, sheets tangled high about his hips, exposing one leg and a smooth expanse of belly and chest. She reached out, tempted to trace a finger down his midline, then changed her mind. The clock on the nightstand read just shy of 8, plenty of time to let him sleep and for her to pull herself together. In the bathroom, she rummaged through the small satchel Jay had fished out of the trunk last night, an emergency bag, he'd called it. She found a small tube of toothpaste, making do with her finger, then showered and scraped her wet hair into a ponytail with a scrunchie from the bottom of her purse. When she emerged, Jay was already dressed, sitting on the edge of the bed, working his feet into his shoes. "Good morning," Leslie said tentatively. "How did you sleep?" It was a trite question, she knew, but she was too anxious to be clever. Dropping the satchel to the floor, she sank onto the arm of a striped silk wingback.
I tried to let you sleep. Did I wake you banging around in the bathroom?
Not at all, Jay said, standing to pocket his change and keys. I'm surprised I slept this late. We've got a long drive ahead of us.
Leslie tried to ignore the alarms going off in her gut. We're hurrying right back, then.
Jay ignored the question. There's a sweatshirt in there. You're welcome to it. It's probably chilly, and the heat in the Mustang takes a while to kick in.
I thought we could get breakfast somewhere, Leslie suggested tentatively. Maybe take a walk down by the harbor?
Actually, I was thinking drive-through. I'd like to get on the road. I'm expecting a call this afternoon, some business I need to handle.
A tight knot formed beneath her ribcage as she watched Jay disappear into the bathroom. He was so eager to get her back to Peak that he couldn't even look her in the eye. Under the moon's soft spell, she hadn't let herself think of consequences. But now, in the cool glare of morning, consequences were all she could think about. Last night had been a mistake, one that would sit between them like some grisly crime scene to be roped off and carefully stepped around. Jay finally emerged, clean-shaven and neatly combed. After a quick check of the nightstand, he zipped the satchel closed and slung it onto his shoulder.
Ready to go?
Leslie sat fixed to the arm of the chair.
You can tell me the truth, Jay. Do you regret what we did last night?
Regret it? For a moment he seemed astonished. Did it seem like I was being taken against my will?
Now it was Leslie's turn to avoid eye contact.
Not exactly, no, but it was my idea, and now you seem like maybe you wished we hadn't.
He crossed the room, silencing her with a long, thorough kiss.
I don't regret anything that happened last night, he said, still holding her chin. I just didn't want there to be any misunderstandings between us.
Leslie stood and sidled around him, pretending to search for her purse.
You mean you wanted to make sure I didn't get the wrong idea and start making rice bags? No, that's not what I mean. I wasn't sure last night was ever going to happen, but I know it was getting harder and harder to pretend I didn't want it to, and maybe I was trying to slow things down, but that's because there were things I needed to say first, before.
I'm a big girl, Jay, and I live in the real world. We both need to figure out where we go from here and if we go together or separately. I get all that. Just please, please don't say you regret last night. Jay smiled, a quick, tight smile that didn't quite reach his eyes.
I won't if you won't.
The morning was spectacular, crisp and clear, with a chilly wind cutting in off the harbor. Leslie offered to drive, but Jay tossed the duffel in the back and slid into the driver's seat. After a few halting attempts at small talk, she gave up. He was clearly not in the mood for conversation, his attention fixed straight ahead with a kind of grim preoccupation she decided she would rather not question. For someone with no regrets, he certainly was having a hard time meeting her eyes. When the Mustang finally crunched up the long gravel drive, Leslie shouldered her purse, ready to bolt the instant the car was in park. They both needed time alone to digest what had happened and decide what, if anything, they wanted from each other.
Thanks for coming with me, she told him over the roof of the car. I guess I'll see you later.
It came out as a question, though she hadn't meant it to.
Jay looked at his watch. I've got that call, but maybe later.
Oh, sure, maybe later.
Good. Then I guess I'll...
Yeah, me too.
In the kitchen, Leslie brewed a cup of tea, then let it go cold while she switched on her laptop and stared at the list of files. She had hoped to lose herself in work, but the muse just wasn't there,
Instead, her mind kept wandering back to last night, to how right it felt to finally surrender to the feelings she'd been fighting for weeks. Had it been that way for Jay, too? It had certainly seemed so last night, but that was nearly 24 hours ago, when the wine from dinner had still been coursing through their veins, the moonlight still spilling through the shutters, playing pale and cool over tangled sheets and damply twined limbs. In the light of day, he might feel very different, a prospect that didn't seem unlikely when she recalled that it was she who had pressed matters, while Jay had seemed uneasy from the moment their meeting with Emily Fournier ended. Weary of pondering the subject and needing something to divert her attention, Leslie considered popping by to visit Angie. But that would almost certainly involve a discussion about why the Mustang hadn't reappeared until this afternoon, and she wasn't at all ready to have that conversation. Instead, she phoned Mr. Randolph to fill him in on what they had learned from Emily Fournier. It was only as she was ending the call that she remembered the Rebecca was still in Jay's trunk. As she brushed out her hair, she tried to convince herself that retrieving the painting was a perfectly legitimate errand, not just a lame ploy to see Jay. But at the last minute, she ended up changing her sweater and dabbing a bit of gloss onto her lips. No reason to show up looking like a frump. The cottage door stood ajar. Leslie knocked tentatively, calling out as she stepped inside. The desk was littered with papers, but there was no sign of Jay or of Belle either. Maybe they were out for a walk. Suddenly, she wished she hadn't come. He was going to see right through this. He'd think she was desperate, or worse, some kind of stalker. She was relieved when she finally caught the sound of running water from upstairs. It felt like a reprieve. She'd leave a note asking for him to bring it by, then beat a hasty retreat. All she needed was a pen and something to write on. When the shower went quiet, she grabbed the first scrap of paper she saw. It appeared to be a list of some sort. Conference call, Simon & Schuster, 9:30 a.m. Flesh out synopsis, negotiate advance ASAP, draft deadline, contact attorney regarding royalty rights. He was writing again? Unconsciously, Leslie's eyes slid to the desktop. It was wrong. She knew, and certainly none of her business, and yet she found herself picking up a stack of neatly printed pages, scanning lines that wove the story of a married man and a forbidden love, the story of a woman named Adele. Her chest squeezed painfully as she flicked through the pages, feeling the reality of them and the betrayal sink deep. All this time? Behind her back, while he'd pretended? Leslie? She glanced up at the sound of her name, hanging in the air along with the scents of toothpaste and shampoo. Jay stood at the foot of the stairs, bare-chested, his hair dripping wet. I've been trying to find a way to tell you. All this time? She said. Her voice a choked whisper. All this time you were writing about it? About her? I wanted to tell you. When? Leslie hurled back as she smacked the stack of pages back onto the desk. When did you want to tell me? While you were pretending not to know anything about the photo Goddard gave me? Or while we were standing in front of her grave that day? I wanted to tell you last night. Last night was a bit late, don't you think? Unless, of course, you dashed all this off after we came back from Charleston this afternoon. She paused, fixing him with scathing eyes. You didn't, did you? Jay sighed. Leslie, I swear this isn't what it looks like. Leslie managed to laugh, a hollow, scraping sound in the small space. Well, that's certainly a relief, because what it looks like is you using my family history to resurrect your writing career and lying to me about it the whole time. But that's not what it is. How long have you been working on it? Jay sunk his hands deep into his pockets and rocked back on his bare heels. I started jotting down notes after Maggie died, but they kind of took on a life of their own after you brought me to the ridge that day.
Notes? It's what I do when a story gets in my head. It was just notes at first, thoughts I couldn't seem to shake. Then, before I knew it, she was walking around in my head. The only way I knew to make it stop was to write it all down. That's how it works for me.
I don't care how it works. I care that you went behind my back and deliberately kept all this from me, that you lied to me.
I never meant for it to turn into a book.
And yet, here it is. What changed your mind?
You did?
Leslie's mouth dropped open. You think I wanted you to do this?
That isn't what I said. And for the record, this has nothing to do with my career. When you showed me the stone and began asking all your questions, it started the wheels turning again. Before I knew it, I had 230 pages.
And this? Leslie held out the scribbled note. Did I inspire this, too? Maybe you'd like to explain how negotiating an advance has nothing to do with your career.
Jay looked away then, his eyes drifting beyond the narrow front windows. Something came up, he answered flatly. I needed to raise some money.
How much will you make?
I don't know, or care, really, beyond the advance. I didn't do it for the money. A family issue came up that needed to be dealt with, and I dealt with it.
A family issue?
Leslie lifted one skeptical brow. Jay's eyes flicked away again, roaming the room for some place to light. If you don't mind, I think it would be best if we stuck with one issue at a time. All I'll say is I did what I thought I had to, in the only way I knew how. Maybe that isn't the way it works in your world, but it's the way it works in mine. I don't expect you to understand or to trust me, but I'm telling you the truth.
Leslie's eyes rounded. You can stand there and talk to me about truth and trust when I just found what I did, when, until this minute, there hasn't been a word about this so-called family issue. What a fool you must think me. And last night?
Jay reached for her, then seemed to think better of it, folding his arms over his chest instead.
Yes, well, we've certainly come a long way from last night.
What happened to nothing changing how you feel? That's what you said, isn't it?
I thought you were going to give me some crap about fear of commitment. I was willing to accept that. Hell, I was expecting it. But I never saw this coming. If I had, I would never have said what I did.
Jay dropped onto the corner of the desk and let his breath out slowly. You weren't wrong, by the way. I did want last night to happen, but not while this thing was between us. That's why I wanted to talk first, because I was afraid of exactly this.
Leslie stared at him, blinking hard against the hot tears that threatened. You were afraid? How hard would it have been to say, Leslie, I've been lying to you since the day I met you. I'll bet if you tried, you could have managed to fit it in while we were polishing off dessert.
Never mind. It doesn't matter. None of it matters. I made a mistake. It won't happen again.
Jay slid off the desk and took a step toward her. I was wrong to not be up front with you. I should have told you that day on the ridge, but it was still just notes at that point. I had no idea it would ever go where it did. Then, when it started to become more, I knew I had to come clean. But by then, the problem I told you about had reared its head, and I did what I had to do.
And went behind my back to do it,
Leslie added stiffly.
Yes.
The simple, one-word admission stung more than anything else he could have said. For an instant, Leslie opened her mouth but realized there was nothing left to say. Turning on her heel, she headed for the door, then paused on the threshold.
"I guess I'll see you on the bookshelves."
Jay was beside her before she could get outside. "And where does that leave us?" It took every ounce of strength in her to look him in the eye.
"There isn't any us, Jay."
"So that's it. That's the end?"
She managed a smile then, a thin, cool curve that didn't reach her eyes. "Yes, that's the end. I should think you, of all people, would recognize one when you see it."
Chapter 36. Leslie pushed the curtains aside and peered out the kitchen window at barren trees and piles of damp brown leaves stirring in the chilly breeze, and felt the familiar pang of restlessness, her constant companion of late. Maybe she should have taken Angie up on her dinner invitation after all, but after 3 weeks of gentle interrogation about what had happened between her and Jay, she couldn't bear the thought of yet another arm-twisting session. She wasn't looking to assign blame or get anyone to take sides. She just didn't want to talk about it anymore. Not to mention, there was always a chance Jay could pop in, which would be awkward, to say the least. They hadn't spoken since the day at the cottage, probably because she'd taken care to avoid any chance meetings. It wasn't hard. Jay hadn't exactly been banging down the door, and she'd done her best to keep her head down, focusing manically on a handful of new marketing projects. Sooner or later, though, they were going to have to talk about what happened and decide how they were going to work together to open the winery. Leslie let the curtain fall back with a sigh and shuffled back to her papers and laptop. Another reason she had buried herself in work was to keep from wondering what Jimmy might be up to and why she hadn't seen him since the night of the splash. Maybe he'd gone and gotten himself nicked again. It certainly wasn't out of the realm of possibility. She didn't care, as long as he stayed far away from Peak. Emotionally, her plate was full. Since stumbling onto Jay's manuscript, she found that she couldn't stop thinking of Adele and the questions surrounding her death. Maybe it was just another way to distract herself from thoughts she wasn't ready to handle, but a part of her was starting to understand what Jay meant when he spoke of Adele walking around in his head. Yesterday, she had wasted 3 hours digging around online, searching for the fates of the boys the police had questioned after the shed fire. She had run a search for Samuel Porter of Level Grove and had finally isolated two possible matches, one long dead, buried beside his wife in Bristol, Tennessee, the other recently deceased somewhere in Maine, while Randy, and indeed most of the Porter clan, seemed to have dropped off the face of the earth not long after the fire. She hadn't bothered with Landis. After blowing 3 hours on the first two and coming up empty, she didn't see much point. Even on the off chance that he was still alive, the man would be in his 80s and not likely to be of much help. And yet now, as she sat staring at the random bounce of screensaver bubbles on her laptop, she felt the pull to try once more. She was too restless to work. Maybe if she promised to limit herself to 1 hour. If she didn't have any luck by then, she would shut it down and force herself back to her work. It was a long shot, she knew, but it was only 1 hour. Pulling up the People Finder site, she typed in Landis Porter's name and then the town of Level Grove. When a single result popped up, she was so surprised she could only stare at it. Landis Porter. Date of birth, 1/12/1925. 121 Old Church Road, Level Grove, North Carolina. Before she could second-guess herself, she had scribbled down the address and was out of her chair, dragging on her jacket as she hit the back door.
She pretended not to notice Jay watching from the barn door as she slid into the car and backed down the drive. She wasn't sure what she planned to say when she got there, or what information, if any, she might be able to mine from the memory of an 88-year-old man, but the churning in her belly told her she had to at least try. The day's chilly mist turned to rain as Leslie headed west toward the edge of town. It was the week of Thanksgiving, and the Christmas tree lots had already put up their signs. She hadn't celebrated the holidays since leaving Peak as a child, unless you counted the occasional turkey pot pie with Jimmy. Now, as she passed by the neatly strung white lights, the thought of skipping them suddenly depressed the hell out of her. Angie had invited her for Thanksgiving, but Jay would almost certainly be there, which meant she wouldn't. Maybe there would be a time when she could sit across the table from him and share a meal like nothing had happened, but that time was still a long way off. A battered wood sign with peeling paint alerted Leslie that she was about to enter the town of Level Grove. It was smaller than Gavin, rural and run down, made drearier if possible by the low gray sky and steady drizzle. Following the directives of her GPS, she turned onto Old Church Road, a rutted strip of pavement clogged with overflowing trash cans, abandoned cars, and various articles of dilapidated furniture. She felt conspicuous as she pulled the Beamer up in front of the mailbox carefully painted with the numbers 121. The house was small, a listing clapboard structure with a sagging porch and rusty tin roof. She was glad to see the column of white smoke chuffing from the crumbling brick chimney. Someone was home. She moved quickly up the cracked walk, dodging a leaky gutter as she stepped up onto the porch. She still had no idea what she was going to say or how she was going to convince whoever was inside that she wasn't crazy. She had just raised her fist to knock when a coarse voice startled her.
"Who you looking for?"
A man in an oversized camouflage jacket sat very still at the far end of the porch, his stringy white hair combed back from his forehead, a scruff of silver whiskers glistening along his jaw. Leslie moved down the porch, feeling the warped boards give with each step. Only when she was closer did she note the cigarette fuming in his right hand and the portable oxygen tank beside his rocker. A much-marked and well-thumbed Bible lay open in his lap. "Would you be Landis Porter?"
"Might be."
Cloudy blue eyes narrowed behind thick, wire-rimmed glasses. His voice was a strange combination of ragged and breathless, a smoker's voice.
"Who wants to know?"
"I'm Leslie Nichols. Maggie Gavin was my grandmother."
"And?"
"And I've come to ask if you remember anything about a fire that occurred on Peak Plantation when you were a boy. There was an article in the Gazette. It mentioned your name." Porter took a long pull on his cigarette, blowing the smoke out slowly.
"Did it?"
Had she imagined it, or had his eyes actually shifted for the tiniest instant? "There were three names, actually. Your brothers, I assume. I looked for them, too, but you were the only one I could locate. I was hoping you might be able to tell me something about what happened that night."
"As I recall it, a shed burned down."
Leslie dropped into the rocker beside his without being asked. He clearly wasn't in the mood to make this easy. "Do you know how the fire started?"
"How would I know that?"
"The paper said the police suspected vandalism. It said you and the other two boys were questioned."
"Questioned ain't arrested,"
he shot back, flicking his cigarette out into the wet yard. A strand of hair flopped over his forehead. He pushed it back.
"Why come around now, after all this time?"
"I just moved back this summer. My grandmother died and left Peak to me." For a moment, she could have sworn she saw something like relief pass over his wizened face.
Did you know Maggie?
Used to do work for her mama way back when. She'd hang around sometimes.
The front windows were slightly open, and suddenly the strains of what Leslie was almost sure was the Temptations wafted out through the battered metal screens, followed moments later by the sound of running water and the clatter of pots and pans. She glanced at Porter's left hand, but found no ring.
"You come here to talk about your grandmother?"
he asked gruffly, steering Leslie back to the subject at hand.
"If so, I'm afraid I can't help you."
"Actually, I came to ask about a woman who used to live at Peak at the time of the fire. Adele Laveau was her name." Porter's face altered then, running through a flurry of emotions before hardening into a stoic blank. He closed his Bible and set it aside, then reached into the pocket of his jacket for a soft pack of Camels. His hands shook as he lit one and took a long pull.
"Can't help you there either."
Leslie played a hunch. "You can't, or you won't." He blinked at her from behind a scrim of smoke.
"Does it matter? Doesn't seem much point speaking of a woman who's been dead more than 70 years.
Leslie folded her hands in her lap and looked him in the eye.
"I never said she was dead, and yet you knew she was."
Porter began to rock, an agitated seesawing that gave away more than anything he might have said.
"Everyone from those days is dead,"
he said hoarsely.
"Just figured this Adele woman would be, too."
"You know something, don't you? Something about that fire?" The rocker went still.
"I'm telling you to leave now,"
he said, his knobby knuckles white where they gripped the arms of his chair.
"And I'm telling you not to come back."
Leslie was unmoved.
"She died that night, didn't she? She was inside when the shed caught fire, and you were there. You and your brothers."
Porter unfolded himself and stood, glaring down at Leslie over his glasses.
"What happened to that woman has nothing to do with me."
Leslie stood, too, and looked him in the eye.
"They say the door was bolted from the outside."
"Leave me alone,"
Porter bellowed hoarsely before slumping back into his chair in a fit of dry coughing. From inside the house came the hurried thump of heavy feet. A few seconds later, the door opened to crack.
"Landis Porter, what on earth?"
The face that scowled through the narrow opening was female, stern and black as tar.
"Who are you?"
she asked, pulling the door back when she spotted Leslie.
"My name is Leslie Nichols."
But the woman wasn't listening. Instead, her wide white eyes were fixed on Porter, hunched over on the edge of his chair, still coughing. With a huff of exasperation, she pushed through the door, squeezing past Leslie to jerk the cigarette from his fingers and toss it away.
"Fool man,"
she hissed, reaching to untangle the coil of clear tubing wrapped around the base of the oxygen tank.
"You know you ain't supposed to have those things, especially here next to this tank. One day you're going to blow us both the kingdom come, and this lady too."
Landis pushed her hands away.
"Stop your fussing, Annie Mae. I'm fine, and Miss Nichols was just leaving."
Annie Mae stood with her fist planted on her ample hips, eyes hard on them both, as if trying to make sense of the tension she had just stumbled upon. And yet, somehow Leslie couldn't help feeling the woman knew exactly what was going on.
"Mr. Porter," Leslie said, taking another tack, "when I walked up on this porch, you had a Bible in your lap. I believe somewhere in there, there's a passage about the truth setting you free."
Landis Porter stiffened as if he'd been struck.
I asked you to leave once, Miss